and truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you. With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own.
Ten days later, in the Senate chamber, where he had spent many years as the senator from Massachusetts, President Kennedy restated that challenge before a joint session of the Congress. He first set forth what he considered were the major problems facing the nation, and what he hoped could be done to solve them, and then ended with this appeal.
Let it be clear that this administration recognizes the value of dissent and daring, that we greet healthy controversy as the hallmark of healthy change. Let the public service be a proud and lively career, and let every man and woman who works in any area of our national government, in any branch, at any level, be able to say with pride and with honor in future years, I serve the United States government in that hour of our nation's need. For only with complete dedication by us all to the national interest can we bring our country through the troubled years that lie ahead. Our problems are critical. The tide is unfavorable. The news will be worse before it is better. And while hoping and working for the best, we should prepare ourselves now for the worst. We cannot escape our dangers. Neither must we let them drive us into panic or narrow isolation. In many areas of the world where the balance of power already rests with our adversaries, the forces of freedom are sharply divided. It is one of the ironies of our time that the techniques of a harsh and repressive system should be able to instill discipline and ardor in its servants, while the blessings of liberty have too often stood for privilege, materialism, and a life of ease. But I have a different view of liberty. Life in 1961 will not be easy. Wishing it, predicting it, even asking for it will not make it so. There will be further setbacks before the tide is turned, but turn it we must. The hopes of all mankind rest upon us, not simply upon those of us in this chamber, but upon the peasant in Laos, the fisherman in Nigeria, the exile from Cuba, the spirit that moves every man and nation who shares our hopes for freedom and the future. And in the final analysis, they rest most of all upon the pride and perseverance of our fellow citizens of the great republic. In the words of a great president, whose birthday we honor today, closing his final State of the Union message 16 years ago, we pray that we may be worthy of the unlimited opportunities that God has given us.
Thank you.
life, President Kennedy said in his first State of the Union address on January the 30th, 1961, life in 1961, he said, will not be easy. No, life would not be easy. Not too hard, perhaps, for most Americans, but very hard for the millions of peoples living in the underdeveloped countries of the world. The people who knew mostly poverty and disease and hunger. The people who had no freedom except, perhaps, the freedom to die at an early age. No, life for them was not easy. And so help for them was one of the first objectives of President Kennedy and the course he had set toward a new frontier. And so on March 1, 1961, he announced the establishment of an army of civilian soldiers, the youth of America, who would wage war against illiteracy and the ravages of ignorance and poverty. The youth of America who would carry the war into dark and distant corners.
I have today signed an executive order providing for the establishment of a Peace Corps on a temporary pilot basis. I'm also sending to Congress a message opposing authorization of a permanent Peace Corps. This corps will be a pool of trained men and women sent overseas by the United States government or through private institutions and organizations to help foreign countries meet their urgent needs for skilled manpower. It is our hope to have between 500 to 1,000 people in the field by the end of this year. We will send Americans abroad who are qualified to do a job. We will send those abroad who are committed to the concept which motivates the Peace Corps. It will not be easy. None of the men and women will be paid a salary. They will live at the same level as the citizens of the country which they're sent to, doing the same work, eating the same food, speaking the same language. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health. I'm hopeful that it will be a source of satisfaction to Americans and a contribution to world peace.
Yes, the 35th President of the United States declared war, war against ignorance and poverty and backwardness. And the Peace Corps was his army, our army. But more than just a Peace Corps was needed by our neighbors to the south, the nations of Latin America. And so on March the 13th, 1961, John Fitzgerald Kennedy acted.
Let us once again transform the American continent into a vast crucible of revolutionary ideas and efforts, a tribute to the power of the creative energies of free men and women, an example to all the world that liberty and progress walk hand in hand.
And so the Alliance for Progress was launched on its way to the new frontier, by the new frontier. But how did it fare? Was it on the right course? Listen to what President Kennedy had to say in his second State of the Union message, delivered to the Congress on the 11th of January, 1962.
The Alliance for Progress is being rapidly transformed from proposal to program. Last month in Latin America, I saw for myself the quickening of hope, the revival of confidence, the new trust in our country among workers and farmers, as well as diplomats. We have pledged our help in speeding their economic, education, and social progress. The Latin American republics have, in turn, pledged a new and strenuous effort of self-help and self-reform.
The Alliance for Progress was on the right course back then in January of 1962. But a year earlier, you'll recall, President Kennedy, in his first State of the Union address, had said that there will be further setbacks before the tide has turned. And the first such setback came in a Cuban harbor that the whole world knows now as the Bay of Pigs. The prestige of the United States was on the rise throughout the free world, on the rise because of such things as the Peace Corps and the Alliance for Progress. But a short month later, in April of 1961, a courageous, ill-advised band of Cuban exiles had attempted to regain their home island from a man named Fidel Castro. They made the try because President Kennedy did not say no. Instead, he took the word of his new and, for him, untested advisors in the Pentagon and in the State Department and in the CIA. But to use the words of NBC's Sander Vanocur in the book Memo to JFK, he had been snowed by the experts. Instead of overthrowing the dictator Castro, 1,113 Cuban freedom fighters were taken prisoners, captives in their homeland. And President Kennedy told the nation,
"On that unhappy island, as in so many other arenas of the contest for freedom, the news has grown worse instead of better. I have emphasized before that this was a struggle of Cuban patriots against a Cuban dictator. While we could not be expected to hide our sympathies, we made it repeatedly clear that the armed forces of this country would not intervene in any way. Any unilateral American intervention in the absence of an external attack upon ourselves or an ally would have been contrary to our traditions and to our international obligations. But let the record show that our restraint is not inexhaustible. Should it ever appear that the inter-American doctrine of non-interference merely conceals or excuses a policy of non-action, if the nations of this hemisphere should fail to meet their commitments against outside communist penetration, then I want it clearly understood that this government will not hesitate in meeting its primary obligations, which are to the security of our nation."
That was in April of 1961. The United States' prestige could not have been much lower, nor could President Kennedy's. But the times and their pressures could not stand still, nor would they stand still while he licked his wounds. But even if they would, he was not a man to sulk. He was a man of action. He spoke with words that all could understand. His kind of language was the kind that all could and did understand. And so he went to Vienna in June of 1961 to talk to a man who also wanted to talk to him. That man's name? Khrushchev.
I went to Vienna to meet the leader of the Soviet Union, Mr. Khrushchev. For 2 days, we met in sober, intensive conversation. And I believe it is my obligation to the people, to the Congress, and to our allies to report on those conversations candidly and publicly. Mr. Khrushchev and I had a very full and frank exchange of views on the major issues that now divide our two countries. I will tell you now that it was a very sober 2 days. There was no discourtesy, no loss of tempers, no threats or ultimatums by either side. No advantage or concession was either gained or given. No major decision was either planned or taken. No spectacular progress was either achieved or pretended. No new aims were stated in private that have not been stated in public on either side. The gap between us was not, in such a short period, materially reduced, but at least the channels of communication were opened more fully. At least the chances of a dangerous misjudgment on either side should now be less. And at least the man on whose decisions the peace in part depends have agreed to remain in contact. This is important, for neither of us tried to merely please the other, to agree merely to be agreeable, to say what the other wanted to hear. And just as our judicial system relies on witnesses appearing in court and on cross-examination, instead of hearsay testimony or affidavits on paper, so too was this direct give and take of immeasurable value in making clear and precise what we considered to be vital. For the facts of the matter are that the Soviets and ourselves give wholly different meanings to the same words: war, peace, democracy, and popular will.
President Kennedy, you might say, was our conscience. From the day of his inauguration, even before, he had told us how we ought to live, how we ought to be, how we ought to let others live, how, when they ask, how we ought to help others live. But from almost the first day of his administration, there was crisis, one atop the other. And in August of 1961, when John Kennedy had been president only 8 months, the crisis was in Berlin, where the communists built a wall. The president talked about it in January 1962 in his State of the Union message.
The threat to the brave city of Berlin remains. In these last 6 months, the Allies have made it unmistakably clear that our presence in Berlin, our free access thereto, and the freedom of 2 million West Berliners would not be surrendered, either to force or through appeasement. And to maintain those rights and obligations, we are prepared to talk when appropriate and to fight if necessary.
If there was one thing that set a theme, set the theme for President Kennedy and all that he did, that one thing was peace. Peace because he knew the horrors of war, particularly the horror of nuclear war. Have weapons, yes, but have more than that too, far more. A forum where men could speak, man to man, people to people, nation to nation.
Guns alone are not enough to keep the peace. It must be kept by men. Our instrument and our hope is the United Nations, and I see little merit in the impatience of those who would abandon this imperfect world instrument because they dislike our imperfect world. For the troubles of a world organization merely reflect the troubles of the world itself. And if the organization is weakened, these troubles can only increase. We may not always agree with every detailed action taken by every officer of the United Nations or with every voting majority, but as an institution, it should have in the future, as it has had in the past since its inception, no stronger or more faithful member than the United States of America.
President Kennedy was a man who wanted peace, but he was a man who would not run from a fight. He was not a man who would look for a fight, but he was a man who could thrive, a man who could blossom on strife. Hear him again in his 1962 State of the Union address.
A year ago, in assuming the task of the presidency, I said that few generations in all history had been granted the role of being the great defender of freedom in its hour of maximum danger. This is our good fortune, and I welcome it now, as I did a year ago. For it is the fate of this generation, of you in the Congress, and of me as president, to live with a struggle we did not start, in a world we did not make. But the pressures of life are not always distributed by choice. And while no nation has ever faced such a challenge, no nation has ever been so ready to seize the burden and the glory of freedom. And in this high endeavor, may God watch over the United States of America.
While President Kennedy was a man who welcomed struggle, he was not the sort of man who believed that struggle was an excuse for totalitarianism and dictatorship. And he said this, too, in that same message.
It is our belief that the state is the servant of the citizen and not its master. This basic clash... This basic clash of ideas and wills is but one of the forces reshaping our globe. Swept as it is by the tides of hope and fear, by crises in the headlines today that become mere footnotes tomorrow. Both the successes and the setbacks of the past year remain on our agenda of unfinished business. For every apparent blessing contains the seeds of danger. Every area of trouble gives out a ray of hope. And the one unchangeable certainty is that nothing is certain or unchangeable. Yet our basic goal remains the same, a peaceful world community of free and independent states, free to choose their own future and their own system, so long as it does not threaten the freedom of others. Some may choose forms and ways that we would not choose for ourselves, but it is not for us that they are choosing. We can welcome diversity the communists cannot, for we offer a world of choice, and they offer a world of coercion. And the way of the past shows clearly that freedom, not coercion, is the wave of the future.
There was another struggle that President Kennedy welcomed, the struggle for supremacy in outer space, a far horizon, a wide horizon for the new frontier. First stop, Cape Canaveral. Next stop, the moon. And an astronaut named Glenn is the first American ever to blast into orbit. The date, February 20th, 1962. Listen.
This is Mercury Control. The MA-6 launch countdown is T-minus 30 and counting. T-minus 30 seconds and counting.
This is the last human control. At any moment, the vernier should light. General Dynamics' Tom O'Malley starts the snapping motor.
The Mercury spacecraft umbilical is out. We're at T-minus 19 seconds.
The firing button.
T-minus 10 seconds. Counting. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2,
there
one,
the ignition of the vernier.
0, ignition, liftoff. The MA-6 vehicle has lifted off. Trajectory looks good.
The spaceship Friendship 7 cut the Earth down to size, and the telephone spans sea as well as land, from White House to a man just returned from the wild blue yonder.
Hello?
Hello, sir?
Colonel?
This is Colonel Glenn.
Oh, listen, Colonel, we're really proud of you, and I must say you did a wonderful job.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Well, we're glad you get down in very good shape. I was just watching your father and mother on television, and they seemed very happy.
Well, it was a wonderful trip. It's almost unbelievable to think back on it right now, but it was really tremendous.
Well, we're going to we'll see you over at I'm going to come down to Canaveral on Friday, and then hope you come up to Washington on Monday or Tuesday, and I'll look forward to seeing you there.
Well, fine. I'll certainly look forward to it.
President Kennedy talking to Colonel Glenn, and now the president talks to the nation about another ocean.
I know that I express the great happiness and thanksgiving of all of us that Colonel Glenn has completed his trip. And I know that this is particularly felt by Mrs. Glenn and his two children. A few days ago, Colonel Glenn came to the White House and visited me. And he was, as are the other astronauts, the kind of American of whom we are most proud. Some years ago, as a Marine pilot, he raced the sun across this country and lost. And today, he won. I also want to say a word for all those who participated with Colonel Glenn at Canaveral. They faced many disappointments and delays. The burdens upon them were great, but they kept their heads and they made a judgment. And I think their judgment's been vindicated. We have a long way to go in the space race. We started late, but this is the new ocean, and I believe the United States must sail on it.
and be in a position second to none.
It was a welcome change for President Kennedy, talking not about another crisis, talking not about the risk we must face in the age of the bomb. It was a welcome change to talk to astronauts and to the nation and the world about our country's accomplishments in outer space. But in less than 2 months, on April 11, 1962, there was another crisis. This one, though, on the home front, and its name was steel. The issue, an unexpected price rise. The action? Listen.
The simultaneous and identical actions of United States Steel and other leading steel corporations increasing steel prices by some $6 a ton constitute a wholly unjustifiable and irresponsible defiance of the public interest. The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission are examining the significance of this action in a free, competitive economy. The Department of Defense and other agencies are reviewing its impact on their policies of procurement. And I am informed that steps are underway by those members of the Congress who plan appropriate inquiries into how these price decisions are so quickly made and reached, and what legislative safeguards may be needed to protect the public interest. Price and wage decisions in this country, except for a very limited restrictions in the case of monopolies and national emergency strikes, are and ought to be freely and privately made. But the American people have a right to expect, in return for that freedom, a higher sense of business responsibility for the welfare of their country than has been shown in the last 2 days. Some time ago, I asked each American to consider what he would do for his country. And I asked the steel companies. In the last 24 hours, we had their answer.
That's what President Kennedy said, and this is what Roger M. Blau, the president of U.S. Steel, answered on the very next day.
When the president of the United States speaks, as he did yesterday, regarding our corporation and its cost price problems, I'm sure a response is indicated and desirable. Let me say respectfully that we have no wish to add to acrimony or to misunderstanding. We do not question the sincerity of anyone who disagrees with the action we have taken. Neither do we believe that anyone can properly assume that we are less deeply concerned with the welfare, the strength, and the vitality of this nation than are those who have criticized our action. As employees and stockholders, we, along with thousands of other employees and stockholders, both union and non-union, must discharge faithfully our responsibilities to United States Steel. But as citizens, we must also discharge fully our responsibilities to the nation. The action we have taken is designed to meet both those responsibilities.
Why so swift and so severe a crackdown? The President of the United States told why in a conversation with three network newscasters, NBC's Sander Vanocur among them, in a December 17th conversation.
I think it would have been a serious situation if I had not attempted with all my influence to try to get a rollback, because there was an issue of good faith involved. The steel union had accepted the most limited settlement that they had had since the end of the Second War. They had accepted it 3 or 4 months ahead. They did it in part, I think, because I said that we could not afford another inflationary spiral that would affect our competitive position abroad. So they signed up. And then when their last contract was signed, which was the Friday or Saturday before, then steel put its prices up immediately. Well, it seemed to me that that was the question of good faith was involved. And that if I had not attempted, after asking the unions to accept a non-inflationary settlement, if I hadn't attempted to use my influence to have the companies hold their prices stable. I think the unions could have rightfully felt that they had been misled. In my opinion, it would have endangered the whole bargaining between labor and management, would have made it impossible for us to exert any influence from the public point of view in the future on these great labor management disputes which do affect the public interest. So I have no regrets. The fact is we were successful. Now, supposing we had tried and made a speech about it and then failed, I would have thought that would have been an awful setback to the office of the presidency.
Throughout his 2 years and 10 months as President of the United States, John Fitzgerald Kennedy showed his interest in the youth of America, in the youth of the world. He saw in them perhaps the hope of humanity, the hope that the word peace would mean just that, peace, peace for all, peace everywhere, peace in the survival of man. Look back at his accomplishments while in office, and everywhere there is youth. Even on the White House lawn as he welcomes 2,000 foreign exchange students to the United States of America.
I want to welcome you to the White House. I'm afraid I had understood that we had 2,000 foreign students, but I'm afraid that your year's stay in the United States has made you at least on the surface look like 2,000 Americans. Whether that's a good thing or not, only time will tell. So we're glad to have you here.
But just as there was joy in welcoming the cream of the world's youth to America, so too there was sadness in honoring the memory of American men who lost their lives on foreign shores, men who made the supreme sacrifice so that all other men could remain free. The President salutes them in his State of the Union message on the 14th of January of the year that also marked his own violent death, 1963.
I think these are proud and memorable days in the cause of peace and freedom. We are proud, for example, of Major Rudolph Anderson, who gave his life over the island of Cuba. We salute Specialist James Allen Johnson, who died on the border of South Korea. We pay honor to Sergeant Gerald Pendle, who was killed in Vietnam. They are among the many who in this century, far from home, have died for our country. Our task now, and the task of all Americans, is to live up to their commitment.
In the first two-thirds of the year 1962, the nation moved along on an even keel, free of crisis, if you can accept such things as the Viet Cong in South Vietnam. Attention was focused mainly on domestic affairs, medical care for the aged, a farm bill, taxes, the budget, and a healthy economy. There were no crises to speak of in those first 8 or 9 months of 1962, but then, suddenly, swiftly, another crisis on the home front. This one on a college campus in Mississippi. An American named Meredith wanted to go to classes there, but it became necessary for the President of the United States to speak directly to the people of that state, Mississippi, and he said this.
You have a new opportunity to show that you are men of patriotism and integrity. For the most effective means of upholding the law is not the state policeman or the marshals or the National Guard. It is you. It lies in your courage to accept those laws with which you disagree, as well as those with which you agree. The eyes of the nation and all the world are upon you and upon all of us. And the honor of your university and state are in the balance. I am certain the great majority of the students will uphold that honor. There is, in short, no reason why the books on this case cannot now be quickly and quietly closed in the manner directed by the court. Let us preserve both the law and the peace. And then, healing those wounds that are within, we can turn to the greater crises that are without and stand united as one people in our pledge to man's freedom.
That was on September the 30th, 1962, a domestic crisis. But then it was October the 22nd, 1962, and there was a much broader crisis, a crisis that easily might have meant the end of all mankind. The buildup of Soviet missiles in Cuba, only 90 miles away from the United States shores, and pointed at the heart of our country. But President Kennedy was up to this crisis too, very much up to it. So in spite of all the risk involved, he took seven steps, the most important of which were these.
Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. This quarantine will be extended, if needed, to other types of cargo and carriers. We are not at this time, however, denying the necessities of life, as the Soviets attempted to do in their Berlin blockade of 1948. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. The foreign ministers of the OAS, in their communique of October 6, rejected secrecy on such matters in this hemisphere. Should these offensive military preparations continue, thus increasing the threat to the hemisphere, further action will be justified. I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventualities, and I trust that in the interest of both the Cuban people and the Soviet technicians at the sites, the hazards to all concerned of continuing this threat will be recognized. Third, it shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
Yes, the President of the United States was up to what the world came to know as the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the chest of every American swelled with pride, because the voice of the man who had spoken the "we're ready to take the consequences" words was their spokesman, our spokesman, the voice of America, the conscience and courage of America. And then it was December, and just about the end of two crisis-riddled years in the presidency. A newsman asked him what those 2 years had been like. What was his reaction?
I would say that the problems are more difficult than I imagined them to be. The responsibilities placed on the United States are greater than I imagined them to be. And there are greater limitations upon our ability to bring about a favorable result than I had imagined them to be. And I think that's probably true of anyone who becomes president, because there is such a difference between those who advise or speak or legislate and between the man who must select from the various alternatives proposed and say that this shall be the policy of the United States. Well, it's much easier to make the speeches than it is to finally make the judgments.
And then newsmen asked John F. Kennedy about the perils of nuclear war.
Once he fires his missiles, it's all over anyway, because we're going to have sufficient resources to fire back at him to destroy the Soviet Union. When that day comes, and there's a massive exchange, then that's the end for because you're talking about 100 Western Europe, Soviet Union, United States of 150 million fatalities in the first 18 hours. So that the nuclear age is a very dangerous period, and that's why I frequently read these speeches about how we must do this and that, but I think they ought to just look at what we're talking about.
Reporters got slightly less global in their questioning. They asked the president only about Berlin.
Berlin is a dangerous position always, particularly because of its geography, because we have to keep communications to an area which is 120 miles behind their lines. So this always gives him a chance to tighten the grip on our windpipe there. But I think he may proceed with some care, because I think he realizes it's a combination of a vital interest and one which has the chance of a direct encounter. So that I think that, as I say, Mr. Khrushchev's speech showed that he knows, and those who are attacking Mr. Khrushchev in the communist camp, particularly the Chinese, as being too soft, I think Mr. Khrushchev realizes the care with which he must proceed now, as do we.
The reporters weren't finished with their questions. They seldom are. They always have just one more to ask. Several years ago, while John F. Kennedy was still a senator, his father had asked him why he wanted to be the President of the United States. And he had replied quite matter-of-factly that he considered himself the best man for the job. And so now, at this roundtable conversation in December of 1962, a newsman asked him roughly the same question.
Yes, I think that the presidency, there's a lot of satisfactions to the presidency, because particularly, if, as I say, we're all concerned as citizens and as parents and all the rest with all the problems we've been talking about tonight. They're all the problems which, if I wasn't president, I'd be concerned about as a father or as a citizen. So at least you have an opportunity to do something about them. And if you, and if what you do is useful and successful, then of course that's great satisfaction. When, as a result of a decision of yours, a failure comes or you're unsuccessful, of course that's a great setback. But I must say, after being here for 2 years and having the experience of the presidency, and there's no experience you can get that can possibly prepare you adequately for the presidency, I must say that I have a good deal of hope for the United States, just because I think that this country, which is, as I say, criticized itself and has criticized around the world 180 million people for 17 years, really for more than that, for almost 20 years, have been the great means of defending first the world against the Nazi threat, and since then against the communist threat. And if it weren't for us, the communists would be dominant in the world today, and because of us, we're in a strong position. Now, I think that's a pretty good record for a country with 6% of the world's population, which is very reluctant to take on these burdens. I think we ought to be rather pleased with ourselves this Christmas.
And then it was January 14th, 1963, and President John Fitzgerald Kennedy delivered his third and final State of the Union message to the Congress of the United States and to all of its people, and also to all of the people of the world. And he spoke about the disarray of the left. He spoke about democracy versus communism.
New nations asked to choose between two competing systems need only compare conditions in East and West Germany, Eastern and Western Europe, North and South Vietnam. They need only compare the disillusionment of communist Cuba with the promise of a hemisphere alliance for progress. And all the world knows that no successful system builds a wall to keep its people in and freedom out. And the wall dividing Berlin is a symbol of that communist failure.
On the domestic scene, there was one accomplishment of President Kennedy's that stood out above all others, a home front accomplishment that will earn him a permanent place and an honorable place in the history of our nation. That accomplishment, of course, was in the field of human rights, the inalienable right of all Americans to be treated equally because they are equal, and no state and no governor can rule it otherwise. There were many presidents who came between Kennedy and Lincoln. 100 years is a long time. But John F. Kennedy did as much, did more, for the Negroes in his 2 years and 10 months of office than did all the other presidents combined. He did it, too, in the typically Kennedy manner, which stated simply is this: when action is called for, act, and when speech is called for, speak. Listen to him as he speaks on June the 11th, 1963. Soft but strong words brought on by the events in Alabama.
We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay?
By the time the president made that speech, he had reached a spiritual point of no return. Earlier, during a speech at Vanderbilt University, Mr. Kennedy had endorsed the right of Negroes to defy local segregation laws. He had characterized it as being consistent with the highest traditions of American freedom. Richard Revere, an author and the Washington correspondent for the New Yorker magazine, followed that particular development of the president's civil rights stance very closely.
What struck me as unique historically was that the leader of a society, the President of the United States, was lending his prestige and support to what seemed to me to be a resistance movement. And it seemed clearer and clearer as the months went on that a resistance movement is what it was. I personally was very thankful that he did do that, but it nevertheless seemed to me quite remarkable and historically certainly unique.
Was the president ahead of the country at that point? It's a question that social scientists pondered. One of them was Dr. Eric Goldman, Rollins Professor of History at Princeton University.
To me, the really important thing about the relationship of the late president and civil rights is the fact that he himself went about the matter somewhat cautiously, waiting for what he called a consensus to form in the United States. That is, he himself did not realize just how far the revolution was going or with what speed. And therefore, when he himself felt it necessary to move, as he did in that famous speech of last June, it meant that this very shrewd student of American public opinion and American life felt that some kind of a consensus there did exist on which he could base a real civil rights policy. I was particularly struck that when he did move, he went rather far, as has been commented upon by Richard Revere, actually not approving, but in a sense condoning of the use of, if not force, threats of force on the part of the Negro. I suspect that in history, Mr. Kennedy's place will be more determined by this particular set of actions with respect to civil rights than anything else. And in this, he will be considered a man who sensed very clearly and very accurately where things were going and at what speed, and who also had the vigor to move on them.
President Johnson assured Premier Khrushchev, too, that he intends to carry on the efforts of President Kennedy to improve relations between the United States and the Soviet Union. This assurance was conveyed in a telegram Sunday, thanking Khrushchev for his message of sympathy on the death of Mr. Kennedy. The text of the telegram was released by the Soviet government Monday. An apparent answer came with a front-page editorial in the Soviet government's official newspaper Izvestia, a promise to cooperate with Mr. Johnson in seeking to reduce world tension. President Kennedy was buried Monday at Arlington National Cemetery within sight of the Lincoln Memorial. His body was carried from the Capitol to St. Matthew's Roman Catholic Cathedral for a requiem mass, and from there to the cemetery to be returned to the American earth. 1 million people lined the streets of Washington to watch Mr. Kennedy's final passage, and almost the entire population of the country witnessed the solemn proceedings at one time or another on television. Following the caisson that bore Mr. Kennedy's body were his widow and many of the world's men of title and power, among them the earlier mentioned President Johnson, President de Gaulle, Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, Prince Philip of Britain, the representatives of more than 90 nations. Lee Oswald, the president's alleged slayer, who was in his turn shot to death, was buried quietly in Fort Worth with only a few members of his family present, and Patrolman Tippett of the Dallas Police, who was shot during the hunt for Mr. Kennedy's assassin, was interred in a memorial court of honor in Dallas. Oswald's slayer, Jack Rubenstein, was moved secretly from Dallas City Jail to the county prison at midday Monday. His lawyers indicated that his defense would be temporary insanity. Rubenstein has now been linked to gangland activities in Chicago. Dallas police and associates of Rubenstein, who goes by the name of Jack Ruby, said the nightclub owner had been a close friend of Paul Labriola and Paul R. Jones, both hoodlums from Chicago. Labriola was shot to death in 1954, and Jones is now serving time in a federal prison on a narcotics conviction. The White House said tonight that the FBI is working on a detailed report of the assassination of President Kennedy and the subsequent murder of the accused assassin, Lee Oswald. The investigation has been ordered by President Johnson, and the findings are to be made public. And the State Attorney General of Texas, Wagoner Carr, announced a court of inquiry would be called to look into all aspects of the two killings. President Johnson was introduced tonight to the British television audience. The BBC broadcast an interview recorded on Mr. Johnson's ranch in Texas just a few days before President Kennedy's death. Senators Barry Goldwater, Republican of Arizona, and Hugh Scott, Republican of Pennsylvania, have proposed a moratorium on partisan political speeches until January 1st. A short time after they made their suggestion, Governor Rockefeller of New York, the only announced Republican candidate for the presidency next year, said he would not push his political effort during the 30-day period of mourning he decreed for New York State. And Chairman William Miller tonight postponed a December meeting of the Republican National Committee, saying that total suspension of partisan political activity was called for during the period of mourning for President Kennedy. The United Nations General Assembly will hold a memorial service Tuesday afternoon for President Kennedy. All other activities, including a scheduled Security Council meeting, are being deferred until Wednesday. And now the official weather forecast for the New York City area. Clear and cold tonight, the low temperature 30 to 35.
This reporter found himself with an open weekend and following the weekly gridiron goings-on and took off for a quick fishing trip to Nassau on British soil. Late Friday afternoon at nearly 5 o'clock, returning to the dock, I suddenly noticed British flags at half-mast. I turned to the skipper of the little fishing boat and asked, "Those flags weren't at half-mast when we left a few hours ago, were they?" He, as well as I and my companion, were unsure. And so it was that on the waters of the Atlantic, we stopped a sailboat headed in the opposite direction. Hailing its skipper, we asked if he knew why the flags were flying at half-mast. He yelled across the open water, "President Kennedy has been assassinated." A shocked, stunned group suddenly burst out, "My God, no." And silently, we hoped that he was mistaken. And thus it was that just a few hours ago, I stood almost on the very spot where President Kennedy stood to be welcomed by the then Prime Minister of Great Britain, Macmillan, in the historic Nassau Conference. Flying back to New York to participate in this tribute to our late president, my mind wandered to the time it was my privilege to have met him not quite 2 years ago, when he attended the National Football Hall of Fame Foundation dinner here in New York to pay tribute to many outstanding American citizens who, like President Kennedy, in their youth were athletes in their college days, and to pay tribute to sports in general. I recall that he seemed so relaxed in an atmosphere that held great appeal for him, even to the extent that he insisted on a program for all Americans, which he fervently urged them to follow. His physical fitness program. and I was proud to have been a member of his physical fitness committee. As he said, to be strong intellectually and spiritually, we must develop and utilize our physical skills. We are an under-exercised nation. But he thrilled a spectator sports as well. He threw out the first ball to inaugurate new baseball seasons. An avid football fan, too, he recently recalled his 21st birthday, not because he had come of age and was eligible to vote, but because it reminded him of a football game. Many of my boyhood heroes, he said, were football stars. And I can tell you from personal experience that even as President of the United States and until he drew his last breath, many of his heroes still were from the world of sports. When Babe Ruth's record was broken, he invited the man who broke it to the White House. As he said, I still thrill to a long run, a solid block, or a good tackle. I'm like a lot of other Americans who never quite made the team, but love the game. And so in this hour of national and worldwide grief, may I offer this prayer to his memory, a prayer written by a priest whose identity we've never been able to find, but expresses the sportsman's creed and the thinking, too, of our late president, whose zest for living included that great love of sports. Dear God, help me to be a sport in this little game of life. Play me where you need me. I only ask for the stuff to give you 100% of what I've got. If all the hard drives come my way, I thank you for the compliment. And God, help me to remember you won't let anything come that you and I together can't handle. And help me to take the bad breaks as part of the game. Help me to realize that the best part of the game is helping the other players. And finally, God, if fate seems to uppercut me with both hands, help me to take that as part of the game also. Help me not to whimper or squeal that the game is a frame-up or that I got a raw deal. And when in the dusk I get the final bell, I ask for no lying complimentary stones. I'd only like to know, God, that you feel that I've been a good guy. Even now, as the shock begins to ever so slowly wear away, we remember him, too, as the author of a book, which, even as in sports, spoke of the many challenges and the dangers of America's great statesman. The hand that wrote it has been stilled by an assassin's bullet, but sadly, it also wrote that book's epilogue, another of the profiles in courage. Sports at a time like this? Yes. For he loved them. And after all, ladies and gentlemen, sports are just games of rules. But one of the greatest rules ever to be handed down to us is the golden rule. Another way of saying sportsmanship. Another way of saying America. Another way of saying John Fitzgerald Kennedy. This is Mel Allen in New York.
November 22nd, 1963. Shortly after noon, two shots ring out from an assassin's rifle, and the course of world history is changed. A young man dies, and all the world pays a reverent tribute. A president leaves the White House in a flag-draped coffin, and people everywhere share the grief of his wife and family. The simple statistics will list him as John Fitzgerald Kennedy, 1917 to 1963, the 35th President of the United States. But the statistics can never tell the story of love and admiration felt by the factory worker in Chicago, the housewife in Los Angeles, the man in the street in Boston or Tallahassee or Wichita. The act of assassination is foul enough, but for it to claim a young and attractive man, a person of dedication, a president who in 2 years and 10 months did so much, this indeed is the highest price.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Alexander Scorby.
We conclude this special program with a musical work entitled The Testament of Freedom. It is a setting of four passages from the writings of Thomas Jefferson by Randall Thompson. The words and the music came into being at crucial periods for the people of the United States of America, both in relation to their own survival as a nation and to their future role in world history. From the mind and the pen of Thomas Jefferson have come the underlying philosophical concepts of American democracy, concepts which found their most eloquent and far-reaching expression in the Declaration of Independence, of which he was the final author. The fourth passage in this work is Jefferson's letter to John Adams, written on September 12, 1821, at Monticello. I quote from that letter. "I shall not die without a hope that light and liberty are on steady advance. And even should the cloud of barbarism and despotism again obscure the science and liberties of Europe, this country remains to preserve and restore light and liberty to them. The flames kindled on the 4th of July, 1776, have spread over too much of the globe to be extinguished by the feeble engines of despotism. On the contrary, they will consume those engines and all who work them. The God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time. The hand of force may destroy, but cannot disjoin them." Thomas Jefferson, 1821. Now, The Testament of Freedom. Howard Hanson conducting the Eastman Rochester Symphony Orchestra and Eastman School of Music Chorus with David Myers, baritone.